Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, October 21st, 2014. The super-secret Stingray cell phone surveillance system is getting unwanted publicity all over the country. Today, it's North Carolina.
Hush, hush, sweet Charlotte, Charlotte. Don't you cry.
Yeah, the FBI wishes the Charlotte Observer would...
Hush, hush, sweet Charlotte, he'll love you till he dies.
This is the fourth major newspaper disclosure about the super-secret Stingray program that we've been reporting on for months here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast. And again, I want to tip the hat that covers my bald head to investigative journalist Bo Hodai, who has done great work in unearthing the information the government doesn't want us to have about Stingray, which is a suite of electronic devices that permits law enforcement agencies to pop a little briefcase at a location and force the cell phones within a certain radius to communicate with that briefcase. And as they target individual cell phones, they sweep up the information and the locations of thousands, perhaps tens of thousands, of innocent people. And I credit the Charlotte Observer for opening its lengthy story with this. Charlotte Mecklenburg police use a secretive surveillance system that collects information from cell phones and wireless devices to locate crime suspects, but also gathers data from innocent people. That violates the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. And as you'll hear, the law enforcement agencies claim alternately that we got to keep this secret so the terrorists don't discover it, and that it is narrowly legal because they're not actually listening to phone calls. They're just collecting the so-called metadata. But I credit the folks at the Charlotte Observer, together with those who broke the story last week about the use of the Stingray system in Washington, D.C., where the thousands of innocent people, including government officials, can be targets of Stingray and they don't even know it. So the Observer reports that in 2012, the Charlotte City Council unanimously voted without any debate to spend about $350,000 to upgrade the cell phone surveillance technology that they had. And the article discloses that among the 46 departments nationwide, the cities of Raleigh, Durham, and Wilmington in North Carolina are all using the Stingray system. And as we've told you, this was originally intended for the NSA and spying on our enemies. Then it was deployed to law enforcement agencies with the promise that it was going to be used only to fight terrorists. But now we're learning that it's used in garden variety criminal investigations, missing persons. And so this creep of a very powerful dragnet device that we're told was just to protect us from terrorists, well, it's being used for all kinds of investigations. And the article also notes that the equipment came from Florida-based Harris Corporation, and Harris claims that it is charged by the government to keep all this secret, and it enforces non-disclosure agreements to prevent local courts and law enforcement agencies from disclosing the use of the Stingray system. Well, we know that any kind of terrorist or criminal is pretty aware that our government can tap your phone, can track your phone, can track your calls, can collect all of this electronic data. And so the idea that we need to keep this secret still to keep it from, you know, being made, well, to keep terrorists from being made aware of it is really just bullshit. And we need to call it what it is. A very unusual scene in Hong Kong last night, after more than 3 weeks of unprecedented protests. On television, They featured a debate between Cherubic-faced students wearing black Freedom Now t-shirts and the number two leader in Hong Kong. Five student leaders, hair disheveled, took on the officials who were old enough to be their parents in a frank discourse. They spoke Cantonese, the prevailing local Chinese dialect, with simultaneous translations into English and sign language. And their counterpart was 57-year-old Carrie Lam, a female, who is the second highest ranking official in Hong Kong. And what's interesting is this was considered a dialogue, but flatly not any kind of negotiation. Now, on their part, the students asked good questions in a very polite manner, such as, what is the next step? Do you have a time frame? Do you have a roadmap to see in which direction constitutional development is going? And what Carrie Lam said is that the government is willing to submit a new report to Beijing, acknowledging the surge of discontent that followed the decision at the end of August by China's National People's Congress to set the new rules for elections in Hong Kong. And those rules essentially say, we pick the candidates and you can decide which one of those becomes your leader. I'm oversimplifying the process, but it's fair to call it that. So Carrie Lam is responding to the charge from students and other protesters that Beijing was given a misleading report by the Hong Kong government on the political mood in Hong Kong. And Ms. Lam rejected that and said the students should accept that opening the election to all of Hong Kong's eligible voters is a significant advance. Quote, I don't know why you don't consider that important progress in our quest for democracy. Well, it's because they know a system that's rigged when they see it. And to pretend to have universal suffrage when the voters don't get to choose the candidates, well, that is not democracy, and the students know that. Then C.Y. Leung, who is the current chief executive and a tycoon in Hong Kong, offered some comments to the media. He said, this is not a negotiation. We have deliberately said it is a dialogue. We're all ears, and obviously we're duty-bound to explain to the students and through the media the constitutional arrangements for us to have universal suffrage in Hong Kong. And so it's hard to predict if this will ease the tensions on the streets, if this will cause protesters to say, well, we've been listened to, that's about all we're going to get, or if they will continue to fight for their definition of democracy. North Korea has released one of three American prisoners who has been held there, an American named Jeffrey Fowle, F-O-W-L-E, was said to have arrived in the United States here on Tuesday after he left Pyongyang on a U.S. military jet. We don't have a lot of details here, but the White House, while welcoming Fowle's release and thanking Sweden for helping facilitate it, has also said that we remain focused on the continued detention of Kenneth Bay and Matthew Miller. Fowle has been held in North Korea for about 6 months, accused of leaving a Bible at a nightclub last May. And I, for one, do not know if these, well, it was three, now it's two Americans who are being held there, are innocent tourists or innocent missionaries, or if they are American spies. Last week, as I've mentioned, I heard Leon Panetta, former CIA director, former defense secretary, and he articulates a very significant threat to the U.S. from North Korea. I frankly don't see it as that serious. But one of his comments is that we don't have any spies in North Korea, any human intelligence. So it would not surprise me at all if these three, now two, Americans have some ties to our intelligence apparatus. It's a big old oops for the U.S. military. Early Sunday, we launched airdrops, not air raids, but airdrops over Kobani, airlifting or parachuting in, pallets of supplies, including grenades, ammunition, and weapons, for use by the Kurdish Peshmerga as it continues to defend the town of Kobani in Syria against the onslaught from the Islamic State. And the oops is, and this is something when I saw the file footage of these crates going out of a C-130 into the sky with a parachute behind it, I just looked at that image and I said, you know, how do you make sure that all of this lands where you want it to and that it doesn't land on the heads of the people we're trying to support? Well, at the time that the U.S. revealed that CENTCOM said that it had conducted these airdrops, they acknowledged that one bundle had missed its target, but they told us that it had been destroyed in a follow-up airstrike. But now, video footage from the Sunni extremists, the Islamic State, have surfaced, and it's up on YouTube today, and a group calling it A3 MAC News, calling itself A3 MAQ News. The video, which is unconfirmed, shows airdrop supplies in the hands of the extremist group. It shows a masked and armed militant examining a package attached to a parachute. He looks into crates containing various munitions, including rocket-propelled grenade rounds and grenades. And then there's a close-up of grenades that appear to be German-made, and Berlin sent 10,000 grenades to Iraqi Kurdistan this past August as part of a consignment of military aid. So the information, again, is inconclusive, but it does appear that the U.S. missed its target. And this is just another example of how the notion that our precision airstrikes can hit the Islamic State without putting American fighters at risk is really a stretch of the truth. And the precision nature of our airstrikes and our drone strikes is something that needs to be skeptically examined. And the idea that we can conduct these kinds of aerial activities without any repercussions or any real cost to American forces, I think, is very far-fetched. And this is what I fear will draw us deeper in to a ground war in Iraq and Syria in the very near future. Every day I pause to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast. Craig Balog is an outstanding man who donates $20 a month to support my work. He doesn't have to, but he chooses to. Deborah Kennedy, Steve Wozenski, Judy Holloway are all monthly subscribers here, and I need you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the sign-up link. It's right under my picture on the homepage. Next page, you get to choose $5, $10, yeah, $20 a month. If you can afford it, I'd love to see it. And you can sign up, too, for our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. I have a few more bonus CDs from John Dist, the Red Flag CD, to pass along to new annual subscribers located in the continental U.S. Well, Ukraine has been pushed off of the front pages and the TV screens in the United States by Ebola and by the alleged threat posed by the Islamic State. But the struggle continues there between the central government in Kyiv and the so-called Russian-backed rebels in eastern Ukraine. And now, the International Red Cross and Human Rights Watch are reporting that on October 2nd and October 5th, cluster bombs were used in the area of Donetsk, or some people say Donetsk. Now, cluster bombs are banned in much of the world, but the United States doesn't support that ban, and we supply cluster bombs to Israel, which have been used in many of the recent assaults on Gaza. So I want to, at the outset, note that any potential outrage in the U.S. about the use of cluster bombs in Ukraine is a little bit selective. Nevertheless, in a report released yesterday, Human Rights Watch says that the cluster bombs were used and that rebels have most likely used cluster bombs in the conflict, too. New York Times says it can't independently verify the use of cluster weapons by the rebels. In any event, this shows that the struggle is ongoing and that at least the Kiev government, if not the rebels too, are becoming increasingly desperate or increasingly aggressive. You choose the term that you prefer. And press officers for the Ukrainian military have denied that they've used cluster weapons during this conflict. They say the rocket strikes against Donetsk in early October should be investigated once it is safe, and they say the rebels had access to powerful rocket systems that could fire cluster munitions. And the New York Times cites the case of October 5th. A man named Boris Melikov was chopping wood outside his home in a neighborhood near in Donetsk when he heard the loud clap of an explosion on his street. And then he noticed that something had hit his back and threw him to the ground, and then he noticed he was bleeding profusely. And the fragments that come from a cluster bomb, which, you know, sets off, well, the cluster bomb drops, and then it releases these bomblets, and the bomblets have small munitions and fragments, whether they're BBs or bolts, and, you know, you can use almost anything, and once it is projected by the explosive, it is lethal. So the report says that hundreds of such fragments, about each about the size of a thumbtack, were sprayed out by at least 11 cluster bomblets that exploded on Melikov Street that morning. And the bomblets are carried in surface-to-surface rockets that are fired from the backs of trucks and have a range of roughly 22 miles. A reporter photographed three malfunctioned rockets, and two of them contained sub-munitions like those that injured Melikov. The same type of weapon struck the Donetsk headquarters of Red Cross on October 2nd in an attack that killed an administrator. I mentioned that Israel has been known to use U.S.-manufactured cluster bombs in the past, and I don't have any information about if cluster bombs were used during the 50-day assault on Gaza this summer. But the massive U.N.-supervised project to rebuild Gaza is getting underway. And according to a report from Al Jazeera, officials in Gaza and Ramallah are doubtful that this will bring immediate aid to residents of the battered Gaza Strip. And that's because the reconstruction plan calls for a highly intricate monitoring system with restrictive measures on the import and distribution of building materials. And this comes at the behest of the Israelis, who have long barred the entry of basic construction materials like cement, metal pipes, and steel into Gaza, insisting that they are dual-use items that Hamas could use to build underground tunnels for military purposes. Now, there's no doubt in my mind that Hamas has diverted these kinds of materials in the past to build their intricate system of tunnels. I'm not surprised by that, but my feeling is that the collective punishment of all of the people of Gaza, consigning them to live in rubble because Hamas might use that material to build new tunnels, is very extreme. Now, on October 12th, donors pledged about $5.5 billion to rebuild the Gaza Strip, but only about half that money is slated for reconstruction. The rest is to support the operation of the government there, and there's a big payroll that goes with that. What's missing in the discussions about donors to rebuild Gaza is what Israel should be contributing to rebuilding Gaza. After all, it was their 50-day assault that created mounds of rubble estimated at many tons and killed more than 2,000 people. But we don't see Israel stepping up to even say, we want to do our part. At least 1,000 industrial buildings, including factories, were damaged or destroyed. And there are many other facilities, including water facilities, electrical generation plants, that were severely damaged or destroyed in this summer's raid. Now, in Gaza, Hamas officials worry that Israel is the one lacking good intentions. The arrangement identifies Israel's security concerns as a priority, giving it the final say on big projects. Only pre-vetted vendors will be able to distribute building materials to Palestinian government-approved contractors. That's what we're being told. Yesterday in Washington, the man accused of being the mastermind of the attacks on the U.S. mission in Benghazi, Libya, in September of 2012, was arraigned and pleaded not guilty in federal court. 43-year-old Ahmed Abu Katala was indicted last June on a terrorism charge, but last week, a grand jury added 17 additional charges, ranging from murder of an internationally protected person to destruction of federal property. He's facing life imprisonment or death. And the defense attorneys claim that the government has not been forthcoming in sharing the evidence with the defense as they are required to do. And the prosecutors say they've given 60 to 80% of their evidence to Katala's legal team, more than 4,000 pages of material, 150 hours of non-classified video, and 500 pages of classified documents. And so this is going to continue for some time. But it is interesting that Katala is being tried in a federal court. He's not being held at Guantanamo. He's not being tried by a military commission. And while it's hard to imagine that there could ever be a finding of innocent once a charge like this has been leveled, we can at least take some solace that we are using the ordinary federal court system to try these alleged crimes and not going outside the law in the Guantanamo manner. And finally today, I have two stories about attempts at censorship. In New York yesterday, the Metropolitan Opera performed its debut of The Death of Klinghoffer. Despite protests from many prominent New Yorks, mostly Jewish citizens, who claim that this is shameful, that it's anti-Semitic, and that the show should be shut down and canceled. And I can understand that many devout Jews, many very assertive Zionists, feel that the hijacking of the Achille Lauro, the role of Palestinians in that hijacking, and the death of Leon Klinghoffer is a very sensitive subject. But to suggest censorship and to say that protests should lead to the shutting down of this performance, this series, is really un-American. And what's shocking is former Attorney General Michael Mukasey, who was the last attorney general under Bush and did quite a bit of damage, he was there protesting with those outside the show, demanding that it be canceled. And how is it that a former attorney general of the United States is willing to trade the First Amendment and the free speech rights of these performers and the playwright? Most of the critics say that it's a very powerful show and that the music is spectacular. And it's not as if this is the first time it's been performed. It's been staged in London, St. Louis, Missouri, Long Beach, California. But to go into New York and to confront these people with their misguided desire for censorship of things that they misinterpret as anti-Semitic, well, I will not tolerate their intolerance. And likewise, there is a move in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania right now, where, of course, the governor is up for re-election, and Willie Horton is kind of out of vogue and out of the news. And so they are diverting voters' attention with an effort to pass an unconstitutional measure with the sole intention of silencing Mumia Abu-Jamal. Now, he's a controversial African-American. He was convicted for killing Philadelphia cop Daniel Faulkner in 1981. I believe he's innocent of that crime, but I know he stands convicted of it. His death sentence was vacated, and Mumia is serving a life without parole sentence at this time. And fascist lawmakers led by a Republican state representative, Mike Vareb, have passed a law in the lower house that they say would stop felons from re-victimizing the families of the victims of crime by speaking to the public. This is breathtaking. Now, earlier this year, Mumia Abu-Jamal was invited by a group of 20 students at Goddard College in Vermont to deliver their commencement speech. And he recorded a videotape in the prison, and it was sent by satellite, and it was shown to an audience of under 100 people. In his remarks to the students, Mumia did not reference the killing of Dan Faulkner, his claim of innocence, or anything else related to his case. And yet, Maureen Faulkner, the widow, is used by politicians to say that she has been harmed because Mumia was permitted to speak to these students. And it's not like they gave him a weekend pass and limoed him to Vermont to do this. They honored his free speech rights. And to date, in Pennsylvania, Mumia has been permitted to write and to record commentaries that are played on Democracy Now from his prison cells. And this effort to claim that this causes harm to the survivor of the dead police officer is just more bullshit. And it's unconstitutional bullshit at that. We're planning an in-depth interview with some of the supporters of Mumia, and we should have that for you in the next week or so here at peterbcollins.com. Thanks for listening to my rants and raves, my news and comment, and I invite you to share this podcast with absolutely everyone. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.